Every December, we like to bring you some of our most popular conversations from the year. Today, it's Michael Adams and his adventures deep down underwater. One of the great things about an Australian childhood is all that time you spend in the water, at the beach or in a pool, and there comes that day, the day when you try to dive as far down as you can go on a single breath. So you gulp down some air and you swim down, swimming against your own buoyancy, and it doesn't take long before every single part of your body is telling you to get back up and breathe again. Michael Adams is an academic, and one of the things he loves to do is free diving. Now, free divers use the reflexes of their bodies to swim down and keep going down, much further down, on a single breath, and then stay there for quite a while before coming back up again. This is something traditional fishing people have been doing for countless generations to collect pearls and abalone and sponges from the seabed. Michael Adams wrote about all this in his essay called Salt Blood. And I spoke to Michael soon after his essay was published in the Australian Book Review and was awarded the Calibre Essay Prize. Hi, Michael. How far can someone go down?
The existing record is around 214 metres.
Oh, no, that's not possible. That can't be possible, surely.
The person who did that, Herbert Nietzsche, he's an Austrian. He's actually dived deeper than that, but not within the frameworks that are required for the record. But he seriously damaged his body in that process. He's recovered again, but he passed out during the descent, had multiple strokes on the way up. So, you know, it's an extreme thing to do. And to go to those depths, they call that discipline no limits. You hold on to a weighted sled, which pulls you down at immense speed. And then when you reach your marker, an inflated balloon pulls you back up at immense speed. So the pressures on your body are just unbelievable.
So you're going to get the bends doing that, aren't you?
No, freedivers don't usually get the bends. It's to do with the way nitrogen works in your system, because the oxygen, the air in your body is being compressed in particular ways. You can get nitrogen narcosis, which is that sort of euphoria, but freedivers mostly don't get bent.
We're talking about nearly a quarter of a kilometre he went down into the water on a single breath. And how long can people stay down there for?
The record for breath hold, which is usually what they call static breath hold, so it's somebody just in a pool, is somewhere over 11 minutes. But 4 minutes is quite usual. I can do 4 minutes or more. And the crazy thing is that you could too. Like, it's already within you to do that.
You're looking very, very sharply at me at the moment, and I feel like I have to go and try this now. Surely, aren't we told that people get brain damage once their brains are deprived of oxygen for that long?
Well, yes and no. You train your body to maximise the oxygen that you're putting into it, so by your breathing techniques. And, you know, when you were describing that kind of every reflex in your body screaming at you to come to the surface, that's actually not to do with oxygen deprivation. It's to do with CO2, carbon dioxide buildup. So one of the things that risky freedivers do is hyperventilate, so take multiple deep breaths and really blow that air out. And what you're doing then is effectively blowing off carbon dioxide. And if you do that, you can stay down without triggering those spasms in your diaphragm, all those things. And it's actually a really dangerous thing to do, so most freedivers counsel very strongly against that. But hypoxia, like lack of oxygen, definitely is a risk. But when that kicks in, is much to do with the physics of the body, is much closer to the surface. So it's what they call shallow water blackout. And in the normal sort of frameworks of freediving, a safety diver comes down to meet you in that critical last 5 or 10 metres, stares into your mask, looking at your eyes to look for symptoms, and comes up with you. And shallow water blackout is quite common. But it happens often near or at the surface, and people come out of it. If there's protection there, people looking after them, it's not significant.
So when you looked me in the eye then and you said, you can do this too, Richard, and assume most people can, first thing I thought was crikey. The second thing I thought was, how? What kind of reflexes do you need to draw upon within yourself to make this work?
You know, it's great that you started off with that story about kids, because we are born able to do this. If you take a newborn and submerge that child in water, they will open their eyes, hold their breath, and swim.
Yes, they will. That's right.
There's a film of it. It's quite beautiful to see.
I've done it with my own kids.
So it's all already there. And as we get older, we lose those capacities. So when you're training to do breath hold, you learn to breathe deep into your diaphragm, where two-thirds of your lung capacity is. You know, mostly in modern societies, we breathe in our upper chests in a quite shallow, you know, way. So you learn to breathe deep into your diaphragm, but you also learn to ignore or understand those contractions of your diaphragm, which are that what they call the urge to breathe. And when you're training, they put an oximeter on your finger, so something which reads your blood oxygen level. And, you know, when, like in normal circumstances, it's 99%, hold your breath for 2 minutes, it's 97%, hold your breath for 4 minutes, might be 90%. Your oxygen levels are still high through those things. And so that's the kind of reassuring feedback. And you're feeling those contractions in your diaphragm, which are very uncomfortable. You know, it's all that thing, you know, breathe now. And the trainers say to you, you know, welcome the contractions. Just feel that and go with it. And in my first training, like if I asked you to hold your breath now, we could do it, but it'd be very boring for listeners. You could maybe last a minute, but within 2 hours with a good instructor, you'd be up to 4 minutes, no problem.
Is it like trying to suppress a hiccup or something like that?
A little bit like that. You let it go, but you don't struggle with it.
How different is it to something like scuba diving?
Somebody described scuba diving, and I've only done little bits of scuba diving. Somebody described it as like driving through a forest in a four-wheel drive with the air conditioning on and the, you know, the windows up, which is my experience. Like there's so much kit. You know, you're wearing all that stuff. There's meters, there's valves, there's dials, there's all those things. And the other thing that I find really challenging in it is the noise of the bubbles. So there's a constant noise. So the last time I was scuba diving was in India in the Andaman Islands, and I just kept wanting to stop breathing because there was so much noise from the scuba around me. And in free diving, it's silent except for the sound of the sea.
So another analogy might be the difference between flying in a jet as opposed to an open glider or something like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Silence, that silence where you hear things all around you and you're much closer then to the elements that are there with you. It requires something that you call an automatic reflex called the mammalian dive response. Is this what you're talking about here, this infant's instinct?
Yeah. So they've done lots of tests and it's quite interesting because we don't know the capacities of the body in free diving, and there's now quite a lot of physiological research going on. And the mammalian dive response, the MDR they call it, it's effectively four things that happen. Initially, your heart rate drops, and then blood starts to move from your extremities into the, as you go down, your lungs compress and you can't have a cavity in your body. So blood moves into that cavity, and eventually your spleen contracts and releases oxygen-rich blood back out into your system. It gives you access to another set of oxygen as you go down. So, and then there's further things that happen in that process. But every air-breathing vertebrate that's ever been tested does those things. They've trained pigs to free dive and put a whole bunch of sensors on them to see what happens.
Pigs, wow. Yeah. Take me through the whole process, please. I'm so interested in how you actually go about this moment by moment. For a start, what's a good place? What makes a good place to go free diving?
You can free dive anywhere. You know, anywhere there's water, effectively. It's just holding your breath and putting your head in the water.
How about for you, though? Where do you like to go?
So for me, like my favourite places have been in Ahmed in Bali and in a place called Hanaunau Bay in Hawaii, and both of those locations are at the foot of volcanoes, and the slope of the volcano just continues into the sea. So at Hanaunau Bay, 100 metres offshore, you can be in 100 metres depth of water. So you don't need boats, you just swim offshore, and, you know, it starts off, you know, 2 metres, and then it just drops away into great depth. And I first dived in the formal structures of free diving in Bali, and it was the same there. You're at the foot of a mountain, a volcano called Gunung Agung, which is the most sacred mountain in Bali. And so you have great depth. You just swim easily, you know, 100 metres offshore. And in that system, they set up a system of buoys and floats and lines and depth markers. So you've got a sort of apparatus around you to keep you located, because you can drift away. If you go very deep without any kind of framework around you, it's quite easy to get disoriented. You lose visibility. The light disappears at 10 metres or 15 metres. And you can when nitrogen narcosis kicks in and you get euphoric, which has not really happened to me, but I've talked to divers about it many times, you can lose the sense of what's up and what's down. So that's quite risky, obviously. But both of those locations, for me, you know, each time your head comes above water, you see the volcano, this great towering cone.
Which is amazingly cool.
Which is amazingly cool. Yeah. And both Gunung Agung and Mauna Kea in Hawaii are sacred mountains. Those are sacred places. And lots of my research and background has been working with Indigenous people. So that sense of the sacred has actually been really important to me. In, you know, the physiological things are really interesting, but I'm in this special place when it's happening as well.
So you swim out 100 metres, there's a volcano behind you, you're there on the water. What are you doing before you go underwater?
You spend time relaxing, fundamentally. You want to shake out all the muscle tension in your body. You breathe deep into your diaphragm, but not forcefully at all. So, you pull air in from the bottom of your lungs, just gradually filling up. You let your rib cage expand in ways which we don't consciously do when we're normally breathing, and then you gently let that breath out. You lie on your back if you're not using a snorkel, or you lie face down if you're using a snorkel. And the instructors often tell you to have a mantra yourself, so some words which are just putting you in the zone. And for me, I used the Beatles song Let It Be. So just singing that to myself.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary, come to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
Let it be. So that's what you're trying to do. You're just trying to let it be. So you're doing that, you're flooding your body with oxygen, you're loosening any tension, any stress, any fear, you're just trying to let go of all of that, and then you take your final breath, fill your lungs all the way, spit out the snorkel and flip over and dive.
And down you go.
And you do it as gently as possible because you're trying not to use oxygen. You know, it's a sort of a perverse extreme sport where it's not about muscle and adrenaline and effort. It's about the least possible effort. It's about being as relaxed as possible. So you kick very gently, and for the first 10 metres, you're working against your natural buoyancy. But once you hit 10 metres, it's the point of neutral buoyancy where the pressure of the water above cancels that buoyancy. And at 10 metres, if you stop, you will just hang there. You won't fall, you won't rise, you'll just hang.
And is your lungs and your diaphragm still filled with air at this point?
Mm. Okay. So you retain the air in your lungs the whole time.
Okay. So then you reach this point of neutral buoyancy. It's like the kind of, I'm trying to remember the name of the point that is, the Lagrange point, is that what it is, in between the Earth and the Moon, where the gravity of the two bodies neutralise each other, and you kind of like perfectly weightless, but but then you've got to keep going down.
And, well, the extraordinary thing from that point is, once you continue, you don't need to move at all. You fall because it's the gravitational pull to the heart of the Earth. So you swim down against that buoyancy, you get to 10 metres, then you just stop and you just keep falling.
Now I just felt this kind of flicker of terror when you said that, particularly if you're in this fathomless sort of place, you can just keep falling and falling and falling to incredible depths if you wanted to.
That's right. And what you also have in the back of your mind is that on the way back up, you're working against gravity. So until you again reach that 10-metre point of neutral buoyancy, and then you're going to be buoyant, you're working against the pull of gravity on that, for the deepest part of that, until you get to 10 metres, and then your natural buoyancy takes over and you start coming up fast and easily. So you have to be pacing your knowledge of your body's ability to handle the hypoxia, the lack of oxygen, on the way down, and then knowing you're going to burn oxygen coming up until you get to that point. So it's pretty challenging. And, you know, there's obviously a physical component to it and complex physiological things, but much of the challenge of freediving is in your head.
I'm with Michael Adams. Michael is an academic based at the University of Wollongong, and one of the things he loves to do is free diving. This is diving down into the ocean or into the water, past depths that most of us would consider even remotely possible, staying underwater for a while and then coming back up to the surface. He wrote a beautiful essay about this that won an award. It's called Salt Blood. It's been published in the Australian Book Review. When do you stop? How do you know when to stop?
It's the level of your skill, what your teachers are training you to do. So, you know, you work progressively in depth because you're initially not relaxed. You're not relaxed.
So, sorry, are you reading some kind of meter that's telling you how deep you're going, or do you kind of not be bothered with that?
Most people wear dive watches, which will tell you your length of time underwater, your depth and all those things. And that is how I started doing it. And that's how people commonly dive. So you know exactly what you're doing, and my dive watch will download it into a computer and graph the whole dive and all that sort of stuff. And towards the end of my time, one of my second or third times in Bali, I met a young woman who never measured anything, not a breath hold, not a depth, not anything. And she was a very good free diver. And it was one of the messages to me to sort of throw away the numbers, the obsession with the numbers, let go of that and just feel what's happening in your body.
So you've gone right down past this point of neutral buoyancy here. And at this point, I'm guessing light is starting to disappear. The surface light is being filtered through the water. And is it quite dark now?
This is the tropics, so you've got a bright sun, and as you come down, you know, the first 5 or 6 meters are bright and colourful and there's fish there, and then it does, as you're looking down, it's darker and darker as you're moving down, and it's quieter and colder as you move down through the heated layers.
Because you're going down head first, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And have you got a flipper on as well? To push you, to propel you down until that point past neutral buoyancy.
And people, I've not used a monofin, but people use those. But freediving fins are like a meter long, particular design to maximize your movement and minimize the effort involved.
What are you hearing as you go down to those levels?
You know, it's wonderful. Like when your head is above water, if you take Bali as an example, you hear cocks, there's ubiquitous, you know, Balinese fighting cocks, you hear motor scooters, you hear outboard motors, you hear people talking. You put your head underwater, all of that disappears or is muted, and you initially hear a thing called snapping shrimp. You hear a crackle, which most people think is in their ears, but it's not. It's little marine crustaceans, which are everywhere. And, you know, you hear the slap of waves. You can sometimes hear the distant sound of outboards, but it's all muted. It's all much stiller. And many divers, including me, often dive with your eyes closed to take away the distraction of the external environment and look inside. So you go down in darkness and it's just getting quieter as you go down.
So you reach the point where you say, okay, here I stop. And then what happens? What do? You stay there or do you come straight back up?
Most people will stay, and that's what the instructors will suggest you do, so that you can relax into the sense. Instead of sort of clinching up about, oh, I need a breath, you can just still. You can just stay and let yourself be embraced by the ocean at that depth. And that's a very cool thing to do, to just hang at that depth and just feel that, you know, you can feel it, the urge to breathe in your lungs, in your diaphragm. But if your training is good and, you know, you've thought through the process, you know you're okay. So, and it's just extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. You're down there and it feels, you know, it's that paradoxical transgression. We're air-breathing mammals, but you go down there and it feels at home.
Oh, that sounds delicious and slightly terrifying and creepy at the same time. Like, oh, I'm meant to be here? Is that what you mean, meant to be here?
You know, it's all life evolved out of the ocean. We spend 9 months in the tiny sea of the amniotic sac. We have gills as part of our embryonic development. So, yes, you know, it's home in an ancient, ancient way.
While you're there, you have a massive amount of water pressure upon you too. Surely the weight of the all that ocean on top of you is pressing down on you, around you. How does that work?
That's exactly right. Every 10 metres down, there's another atmosphere's pressure. So at you know, there's one atmosphere at the surface, 10 metres down, it's doubled. So 40 metres, which is what my son has dived to regularly, is 5 atmospheres of pressure. You don't feel it. You feel a sense of pressure, but not discomfort. But there is significant risk from that of what the medical profession called barotraumas, pressure-induced injuries. So my son, when he first dived to 40 metres, you know, the first time you do some depth which is beyond what you've done, it's pretty nerve-wracking. And the instructors say to keep your body vertical. You don't look down and you don't look up. You keep your spine in a straight line. And when he reached the 40-metre depth mark, he looked back up. And what that does is stretch your trachea, and 5 metres of atmosphere ruptured blood vessels in his throat, so he was coughing blood by the time he came back to the surface. But divers like to underplay those things, so they call it a throat squeeze. Oh, you've had a throat squeeze, spitting blood into the ocean. But then they pull you out. You know, you can't dive for a few days because you've actually injured your throat. And you can do other injuries, but if your physical performance is good, if you are graceful and controlled, no problem at all.
When you are there in a place where we're sort of, like you're saying, it feels like we're meant to be, but really we shouldn't be, or we should, or I don't know. It's a complex thing, isn't it? Do you come quite close to a thought about death in that moment?
I personally do. Most divers I've spoken to absolutely deny that death is anything to do with it. They all say, no, we don't think about death. It's got, you know, we've got all these safety procedures. It just feels great, blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't what I was feeling at all. And it wasn't about fear. It was this paradoxical sense of, I don't know, compassion and other things about being, knowing that all I have to do is open my mouth, all I have to do is breathe out the air in my lungs, and that's it. I will not get to the surface. So when I wrote this essay, I sent it to one of my instructors, the one who taught me all the safety stuff, and I said to him, Matt, you may be not going to like this because of what I say in there. And he wrote back really beautifully, and he said, it reminded me of why I started freediving, the eternity between moments. And then he said, freediving as bardo state, B-A-R-D-O, which is a Tibetan concept of this liminal state between life and death, this point of balance.
And when you're in that point of balance, what does life and death look like?
The trivia of everyday life falls away. All of the conventional things we waste our time on fall away. And I think this is what it is for me, the sense that you are, you know, just one tiny speck amongst all these other living things on the planet. You're just one piece of this gigantic, complex, living, pulsing puzzle. And, like, it's very humbling. That's one of the things I like about it. You know, we tend to think, put humans at the top of the pyramid, think we're the boss. Down there, you're not the boss at all.
Can you stand back and look at your own life with something like affection in that second?
Yeah, so freediving has helped me gain some understanding of the traumas of my life, if you like, my own life, some sense that, yes, I might have these traumas, these injuries, these, you know, unhappiness, whatever it is, but there can be a place where you can go beyond that.
When do you know it's time to come back up?
Well, what you were going with is the feeling in your body, because you're not wanting to use your brain. You're not wanting to think in a technical sense, because it actually burns oxygen to think. So if you're in a euphoric state, you have to think, oh, yes, that's right, I have to breathe.
So the reasonable mind has to walk into the room like the adult with the kids and went, all right, kids, you've had your fun now. Is it a bit like that?
That's exactly right. And I've not really experienced that, but divers certainly talk about that. So for me, it's just thinking, okay, I need to pace myself. This is very cool. It's probably time to go up.
And then what happens? How do you ascend? You have to fight, you say, don't you?
Yeah, you have to swim, and the big fins really help. But again, it's doing it gently to maximise the propulsion with the minimum oxygen, streamlining your body, relaxing your leaving your arms loose, keeping your spine completely straight, so not, you know, arching your head, not looking up. And then you reach 10 metres. And I think of 10 metres as kind of the gateway, you know, that point where it all changes in both directions. And then after that, you're coming up with your own buoyancy. And as you're coming up, the light is increasing. You're coming up towards the sun. You know, you can see this great diffuse orb on the surface of the sea from underneath. And you're going up towards that and towards your buddy divers if they're up there. And then you come to the surface and you do what are called recovery breaths. So it isn't, you know, thrashing around and gasping and feeling really stressed. You do a series of and breathing in quickly and holding it, and then doing three or four more of those. And after you've done that, you're not out of breath. You're just fine. And, you know, your buddy divers are watching you if you've got them there, looking at your eyes, looking at whether your lips are blue, you know, generally checking you out. And it's in one sense lovely to come back to the surface, and in one sense it feels like a loss. Like you've left this extraordinary place and you're back in the everyday, and you can hear the motor scooters and the boats are there and the other people are there.
So it's not euphoric then, that feeling
arriving, to come out
of it? No.
No, that's my feeling. It's not.
And that's the common feeling, do you find?
It's hard to know because, you know, at Ahmed in Bali, one of the things which was extraordinary, there was the experience of the diving, but the community of divers, it's this, you know, strange sort of itinerant polyglot group of people who love doing this thing. So, you know, we dive for a few hours and then we come back in, and because your body can't take it, you know, that you have to pace yourself, and everyone is euphoric. Like, it's, you know, people are laughing, people are relaxed. There's a lot of sort of physical affection. So, you know, coming out of the water after a diving session, you really have been transformed. Like, your body has dramatic things have happened inside your body and inside your head. Like, it's a meditative experience, effectively. You're not trying to prevent thoughts. You're just trying to let them go. And, you know, mostly we have the monkey mind, you know, the ramshackle things going on 100% of the time. And to free yourself from that is very wonderful. So after you've had a session of that, to come out with a group of people who've also done that, and they understand what's happened to you, is a really lovely experience.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
You said when you were down there, it helps you deal with some of the traumas in your life. Tell me a bit about your family. How did you come to be born in India?
On my mother's side, I'm the fifth generation born in India. So her family were part of the whole British Indian tradition, the whole colonial process.
The Raj, right.
The Raj, exactly. She was born in Lahore, but grew up in the foothills of the Himalaya. And by the time she was born, they'd run out of money. She was kind of an extra unplanned child. And so she had very limited schooling, probably a quite wonderful childhood, hunted in the mountains with her father, had many Indian friends. She speaks Hindi and Urdu fluently, grew up in a village where there were Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, Jain, you know, local, whatever. And, you know, one of the gifts to me, I guess, was a belief that you respect all religion. So, which is, you know, unusual for an Australian, perhaps. And it was maybe one of my entrees into working with Indigenous people where there were no barriers for me there.
What would have happened to her family during partition after decolonisation when India split into India and Pakistan?
So my mother was 16 at the point of partition, and they lived they had a guest house in this small village. So this is a village where they knew everybody. They lived there forever, and the village then tore itself apart. Her father gave her a gun, and he had a gun, and they patrolled the house, and he said, "There's five bullets in that gun, and the last one is for you."
That's how it was. How did your parents meet?
They met in India. My father was there in the Second World War and loved it. He was British, returned to England, kind of half-trained in horticulture, and went back in tea. I think they'd give you a job as a tea planting manager if you were white, basically. So they then worked on tea estates in the northeast of India she must have only been 20 or so, through to 25, 26. And my brother and I was born in Calcutta, and my brother was born in Darjeeling.
So then they came to Australia. What kind of a life did they have once they moved here?
I think, you know, the British all started bailing out. And so some of my uncles went to New Zealand, people came to Australia. And because my father wasn't really qualified for anything, and neither was my mother, they had, you know, a whole series of different jobs. And I grew up in Brisbane. The earliest thing I remember is Cooper's Plains. We had a corner store. They ran a corner store. My father worked in BP garages, you know, a range of different things. He'd done some medical training, and he eventually got work in pharmaceutical wholesale companies with, you know, big warehouses as a kind of a warehouse supervisor or something. And, I mean, it wasn't until I guess I was, you know, in my teens, I realised that my father was effectively an alcoholic and an addict. So
he was helping himself to some of those supplies?
Absolutely. The uppers and downers from the, you know, from the warehouse. And, you know, when you're a kid, like, there was no violence, there was no fear. When you're a kid, it's all just normal. He smoked 40 cigarettes a day. He drank a lot, I assume now. Like, there was just always a drink in his hand and always cigarettes. And his behaviour, when I look at it from this perspective, you can see, you know, potentially the effects of uppers and downers in his system. But for me then, as a kid, it was just normal. It's just what we did.
Is that one of the things, do you think, or other things that drove your mother to leave the family home when you were 11?
I don't know. That was just kind of announced to us one day that Mum was going to Sydney, and car. I was 11, my brother's 18 months older than me. No real explanation. And so she just disappeared out of our lives. And then we lived with my father for, you know, a couple of years after that. And there must have been some exchange of letters with my mother, but it was pretty perfunctory in various ways. We didn't have money. We lived in a ramshackle. We lived in a whole series of different houses, but a ramshackle Queenslander in Yeronga was the last place I remember.
This is just you, your brother and your dad, is it?
That's right.
And how did your dad cope with raising two boys on his own?
Look, we did it ourselves, I guess. You know, we used to come home and I could tell you what we ate for dinner, which was out of a tin and out of a packet. You know, we'd do it ourselves, which was fine. And, you know, none of that felt bad, really. It just felt normal. Even, you know, even mum leaving, you just kind of, I don't know, it just sort of fits in.
I think everyone's family feels normal until you realise that they're not.
Exactly.
So how long did your dad stick it out doing that?
So we were there from, you know, 11 till when I was 13. And then, you know, we came home one day after school or something and dad said he'd lost his job, the car was being repossessed and we had to move out of the house. And actually, we had to move to Sydney to live with my mother. And he'd obviously been in communication with her. We absolutely didn't want to do it. And because, you know, she'd telegraphed the leaving, you know, that had already happened. And she didn't want us to do it. So, you know, when we came to, she was living in Western Sydney. She had a new partner who was a detective inspector of police. You know, we got the message that she was not happy with this situation.
Oh, right. She was there under sufferance.
Yeah, exactly.
And how did you get on with her new partner?
Very badly. Mm. And, you know, 15-year-old boys in particular is a terrible age. You know, you're rebelling, you're pushing against boundaries in all kinds of ways. So we had that plus everything else. And there was tons of tension. Like, he took me into the police station to show me the police cells and show me these mangled wrecks of cars with blood pool beneath them to say, that's where I'm going to end up.
Where you were going to end up?
Where I was going to end up because of my behaviour. My brother, for one of, you know, numerous infractions when he was 16, was thrown out of the house. So he never finished school, which, you know, replicates what happened to my father and to my mother. He moved in with a friend, but, you know, tried to stick it out at school, but didn't happen. So he's 18 months older than me and we're quite close. I have 4 tertiary qualifications. He has no qualifications. He can drive anything with wheels. He can fix any engine. He can build anything, but he has no formal qualifications.
What kind of contact did you have with your dad in those teenage years?
We used to write, and I'm sure it was as erratic from him as from us, you know, as a kid, like writing a letter. But what we used to write was, we want to come home, we want to come home, like come back to there. But he'd moved from the house, and so there was a kind of a rolling series of addresses, and eventually he bought a caravan with a new partner, and they were just drifting in Queensland. So there weren't even addresses. We were, you know, we'd send a letter to somewhere, sometimes it would get returned, or sometimes he'd write back and say, send it to this, like his company, and they would forward it to wherever he was. So the link was very tenuous.
What was the tone of his letters?
It was, you know, I guess it's really hard to say that, maybe dutiful, you know, because we're saying we hate it here, we want to come back. And he's saying, you know, no, you just have to stick it out, everything will be fine, I can't have you back, I can't do it, we don't have a house, you know, all those things.
Was there a, sort of a sense of, did you ever doubt his love for you at those times?
I mean, I think as a kid, you don't doubt that. But, you know, we were clearly deeply unhappy, both my brother and I, and there was no solution. There was no offers. And then we were woken up in the middle of the night by my mother. You know, went out in the living room. She said, the police have just been, your father has been found dead on a beach in Queensland. That's it.
Did they tell you he'd taken his own life at that stage?
No, not then, but that did become the, you know, the death certificate, which I saw this year for the first time, does not say suicide. It says cause of death suffocation, which means he asphyxiated on his vomit. But he, as I understand it, took a handful of downers and a bottle of scotch. And the other kind of strange thing that's happened is that his sister, my father's sister, my aunt, who's now 92 and was an extremely successful doctor in England, she sent me a whole batch of letters from my father's then partner, which I didn't know existed, had never seen. She doesn't know I've written this essay. So this just happened in the last couple of weeks. So I'm reading all these letters, and the letters all clearly indicate that everybody understands it as suicide.
Could you talk to your brother about it?
Yeah. And he, you know, Alan, his name's Alan, he had had less of a kind of a belief that it was suicide because it had been presented to us as ambiguous. You know, he died and they hadn't found him for several days and it was asphyxiation. So,
and it's pretty easy to pick up the vibe from grown-ups. Don't ask any more questions
about it. And, you know, so we didn't ask, I don't even know if there was a school council. I didn't tell anybody. You know, we spoke to no one about that.
Did you get counselling eventually over this?
In my life, I'm up later to number 10, I believe.
Yeah, really? Okay. Has that helped?
Yes, some of the time. I on and off see an actual counsellor, a psychologist now, and she has, because I took a very deep tip into, like, my GP, all these people, this is the last 2 years, diagnosed me as having extremely severe depression, and that group of people helped me, and accidentally I started yoga as part of the free dive training to make my body more flexible, a bunch of other things, and yoga has been absolutely wonderful. I have extraordinary teachers who have actually really helped my recovery.
Why has that helped?
The reason I believe in it is that I went in as a cynic. I exercise, like I'm used to physical things, that's fine, but, you know, chakras, all this stuff, I thought, you know, what is all that about? But as I, you know, continue to do yoga and listen to my teachers and do what they say, it does wonderful things to me, both to my body and to my heart. You know, we deal appallingly with mental health, and I actually hate the term mental health. Like, surely it's just health.
Health, yes, you know? Yes.
And so, you know, you get 10 visits subsidized by Medicare, and then that's it. And so when I ran out of that, I went to my yoga teacher and told him the story that I'm telling you and said, Steve, what can I do with you about this? It has really helped me in many ways. He's not a counsellor, and he doesn't try to be a counsellor. He's just saying the yoga traditions can help you do this.
Once you became a father, did that lead you to reflect more on what your father had done?
Absolutely. Once my son was in his early teens, I was thinking to myself, I have no roadmap for this. I had no father parenting me in my teens. I don't know what to do. And it was pretty confronting. He was terrible at 15. Mm. He's great now. He's 20. But he was, you know, pretty tough at 15. And I was really quite challenged by all of that. And it was the combination of thinking, well, that love and care was not there for me when I was in that space. And, you know, I absolutely want to make that there for my kids. And, you know, it's what you do as a parent, like you're fully committed to doing that. But it did bring it all back up for me, the whole challenge of the lack of parenting in my early teens.
When you were talking about freediving before, it seems that yoga thinking or the ideas that surround it seem to be quite strongly linked to the practice of freediving. Is that right?
Yeah. So many freedivers practice yoga and or other meditation traditions like the Vipassana, the 10-day retreat. And it's in part about what it will do to you physiologically, yoga, breathing techniques, pranayama, a whole lot of things like that. And it's partly about quietening your mind, about letting go all that chatter in your mind in different ways. And the message to me has been about opening yourself. You know, I think when the kind of things that happened to me in my childhood happen to you, you armor yourself. You know, you've been hurt, you've been rejected, there's been all these things happening, so you start to build walls to protect, you know, to stop that continuing to happen to you. And initially freediving and then yoga taught me to let the walls down. You can't free dive with walls. It doesn't work. You need to be vulnerable. You need to be open. You need to be relaxed. and the yoga traditions has really helped me. You know, in yoga, there's particular poses that they refer to as heart openers. So that's been the message to me, because I obviously have, and probably have had all my life, deep-seated anger about my parents sequentially abandoning me as a child, which is not good or useful. And so finding a way to let go of all of that. And, you know, I don't know whether it's around forgiveness. I don't know exactly what it is. It's just letting it go. And, you know, you raised my relationship with my children, and that was the flip side of that. That was the love that you can give them and they give you, you know, which is extraordinary and beautiful in all kinds of ways. And it was, you know, the yoga traditions, I guess, you know, as I said, in freediving, you feel like this tiny speck, you know, in the immensity of the planet. The yoga traditions can take you to that place as well.
There's a large part of the Buddhist tradition is compassion is a huge part of that, and a kind of disinterest as well. And by disinterest, I don't mean uninterest. I mean a kind of ability to sit back from something and look upon it with compassion. When does that happen? Does that happen before you go down, or does it happen when you're floating there at the bottom of where you need to be in the ocean?
Well, the non-attachment philosophy in Buddhism, yeah, I think it's a journey in the dive where, you know, at the top it's the everyday world, it's the noise, it's all that stuff, the paraphernalia, and then as you start to go down, you're just discarding and discarding. And then, you know, when you get to the point of stillness, well, that's it, the point of emptiness, the point of, you know, when it really works, which is not all the time, or not all the time for me, it is that it's compassion and that sense of unity, that sense of connection to the rest of everything, the planet, the ocean, the biggest thing on the planet. And interesting, because I once went from freediving in Hawaii to a 10-day Zen retreat in America, which was wonderful, because they were so close.
Allowing yourself to be that vulnerable down there, does it sometimes go the other way? Do you sort of almost feel like, I don't know, crying or bursting into tears or something, or laughing or something when you're right down there?
All of the above.
Really?
So, and yoga does it too. You know,
That's clearly a bit dangerous to be doing
that. It unstitches you, yes. You know, in various kinds of ways. So absolutely, as you're saying, about making yourself vulnerable, and things, you know, suppressed things emerge in various ways. And it's absolutely happened to me. And freediving, in ways which for me so far are entirely unpredictable, do that too.
Do certain thoughts sort of walk out, right out, and sort of plonk themselves right in front of you and go, this is here, and I wasn't expecting that?
For me, the thought of death is the one that does that. Yeah. You know, I quote in that essay Simone Weil, the philosopher, and she says something like the possibility, recognizing the possibility of death that lies locked up in each moment. You know, all of us as living things are subject to so much risk and danger in a daily thing, everything on the planet that lives. And humans, we distance ourselves from that. We put risk management things, safety structures, all that. We don't want to know about that. But for most things on the planet, life is uncertain, and for humans too. And that's what comes into me, that sense of the fragility. And it's not frightening, which is the really interesting thing.
You trained in Hawaii with a legendary diver, a man who's actually in his mid-70s now.
Carlos Isles, that was an absolutely key event for me. I'd trained in these modern sort of structures with safety, Boyle's Law, buddy diving, you know, ropes, all that stuff. I met Carlos again in a sacred place at the foot of Mauna Kea, the most sacred mountain, the tallest mountain in the world if measured from the seafloor. And we dived at a place called Hanaunau Bay, which has an archaeological site called the Place of Refuge. So the water, the land, the mountain, the whole place is deeply sacred to Native Hawaiians, and I was very aware of that, being in that place. Carlos Isles is aquatic. Like, you know, he spent probably more time in the ocean than out of it, all over the world, extraordinary experiences of all forms.
What does he look like, if you don't mind me asking?
He's deeply tanned, skinny, mm-hmm. and battered, and an extraordinary person. You know, we, in normal freediving, there's a whole bunch of, you know, discussion about safety, about blah, blah, blah. With Carlos, we sat on the rocks and talked philosophy for an hour before we dived. And he said to me, I can't, this is not something that I can transmit verbally. And he used the analogy, he called it catching the rock, that you can't verbally, like in a lecture theatre, teach somebody to catch a thrown object. It has to be embodied. Your whole self has to be part of that. You can't give a lecture on how to catch an object. You've got to do it. And so he said, that's what we're going to do. I'm going to dive and you're going to watch what I do and then you're going to do that.
Well, you can say that, but how do you heed that? I mean, I suppose it's like learning to drive a car too, eventually becomes second nature in a way, complex operation.
I mean, it was partly, I guess, where I was in my own freediving journey. So, you know, I had a level of competence. It wasn't alien to me. And, you know, I think the point of that conversation was for me to trust him, for me to get to know him. So him not just showing up as a teacher and me being the student, but this being a person that I can trust in this situation in all kinds of ways. And we dived repeatedly together with him sort of watching me, correcting little things, talking to me about stuff. And then we came up and he said, let's just go for a swim. And we swam about a mile out to the point. We just swam out to sea. And Moana Kia just goes straight into the ocean. And 100 metres offshore, you were in 100 metres depth of water. And you look down past your fins into that blue abyss, and it's pretty extraordinary. And Carlos says, you know, pretty soon the sharks will start circling, but they're circling in your brain. He says the sharks circle in your prefrontal lobes. There are no sharks, or maybe there are sharks. It doesn't matter. It's the ones in your brain that are the problem to you, and you just have to let it go.
It seems like the way you talk, this business of freediving, has it made you calmer or more joyful or both?
It's probably done both of those things. It's made me more humble. It's, you know, made me aware of the appropriate place of humans on the planet, which is, as Aldo Leopold says, a plain member of the biotic community instead of the boss, just one among innumerable many, and small and fragile and vulnerable. You know, humans are puny compared to just about anything else.
Ocean teaches you like that, like nothing else can in this world.
Absolutely. The biggest thing on the planet teaches you that, absolutely.
You're less than a dot.
Yes. Yeah.
That's not a bad thing in a way.
Look, I think it's a wonderful thing. And the, you know, I don't know that I'm a joyful person. I don't know that I've got to that point. But there is this sense of, you know, compassion and peace, I guess.
That's pretty close to joyfulness, I think. It'll probably do for the moment. Yeah. Are you trying to compete against yourself? Is that completely meaningless? Are you trying to go ever deeper when you go down?
Well, initially, it's what we were saying about, you know, working with your dive watch and the minutes of breath hold and depths of that you've gone underwater. That's what I was doing. And Carlos really taught me to throw that away. Carlos said the words he used were, the ocean is not a linear system. Like, numbers do not work. Throw away the numbers. You just have to let yourself be in this place and see what happens. And, you know, yes, there's technical things as part of it, but that was a really powerful lesson for me. And it kind of reinforced, you know, the many, many lessons I've had from Indigenous people everywhere about just being part of things instead of managing or controlling or dominating or having risk management frameworks or, you know, whatever they are, just letting it go. As I said right at the beginning, let it be.
You mentioned before your son does this as well, and it sounds like he can go even deeper than you can. How hard is that to watch your son go underwater and not come up for how long? 1 minute, 2 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever, on the single breath?
So he was instantly really good at the, you know, I think the, you know, the earlier you start, like, has no trouble equalizing. He just got it all really quickly. So on his second day ever, he dived to 20 metres with no problem. And then he interned in the dive school and he's now repeatedly done 30 and 40 metres. But when, as you say, like, so the first time I watched him, I'm lying on the surface with my mask in the water, you know, breathing through the snorkel. I watch him go down, the visibility disappears at 10 metres. He disappears at 10 metres. And then I'm just waiting, looking at the darkness with nothing happening until he eventually reappears, totally relaxed, perfectly graceful, doing everything right, you know, drifting up completely in control to the surface. And, you know, it is terrifying. It is terrifying. But it's also, you know, you're your children going out into the world. And for him to have the experience now at age 20 to have discovered this extraordinary thing is wonderful.
Would you ever want to be an astronaut?
No, I don't think I want to be an astronaut.
It's been so great to speak with you, Michael. Congratulations on winning the Caliber Essay Prize for your essay, Salt Blood. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you and hear about this extraordinary practice. You wouldn't call it a sport, would you? A pastime, practice, discipline. Discipline, I like discipline, perhaps.
A path, I would call
it. A path, it is.
The blue path.
The blue path. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks, Richard. That was fantastic.
Michael Adams' essay, Salt Blood, is published in the June-July edition of the Australian Book Review. If some parts of Michael's conversation were a bit troubling for you, you can always call Lifeline 13 11 14 13 11 14. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.